Welcome, everybody. Good to have you all here. Let me introduce the panel. And, you know, all good shows have to come to an end. The Wire, other shows as well. We have a new one now. Here we go. So, Nina Noble is to my left, executive producer of The Wire, who's been working with David Simon since the beginning, really, for a long time, and they'll go back a long way. And to her left is Clark Johnson, who was in a homicide, is becoming a director of Great Note, and played the role of Gus in this season of The Wire that just concluded. And to my right is Chad Coleman. And Chad, if you remember, played Cuddy in The Wire, one of the most memorable roles for a lot of us. And to his right is Bill Zorzi, who I think played himself.
A version.
A version of himself. And is one of the, of course, lead writers on The Wire. Made an incredible transition from journalism to screenwriter. So this is our panel. So, and we have a mic. The microphone right there in the middle, and as I like always do, let's have a real community conversation here. So when the spirit moves you, please come to the mic and bring your questions and thoughts to the panel, okay? And we're going to cover a bunch of things. And I think that we have here people in production, actors, writers, directors. And I think people are very curious about how these pieces get put together and how much of a collaboration there is going on between actor, writer, director, producer on the scenes. I mean, and how much people get to interplay about what you do or how much is dictated by what is already written. Zorzi? We start with you.
Oh, yeah. What did you say about the spirit moving you? I guess I have to move me first.
No, I can move to Clark Johnson. I'll move to Clark first. I'll move to Clark.
I guess the do you want to talk about how it happens on set or
yeah,
just the whole process?
Let me tell you what I mean. I've heard from some people that said when you have a script and when you're given the script as an actor, that's your script. Let's not veer away from what's written. So what is the creative process between people who are doing the acting and the directing and the producing on what we finally see?
The actors will do as they're told. No, as writers, we put it on paper the way we see it, and everybody leaves their mark on it, you know, whether it beginning with the actor when he or she reads the part, the director has his or her ideas about how that actor should play the part. We might be on set. There's always a writer on set, so. The director may ask for our input or ask if, you know, this is the way we envisioned it, or if we did it this way, is that going to affect something, you know, three episodes down the line? So it really is a collaborative effort, I think.
Basically, it's shaking the bushes here, boss. That's our response to the writer types. We're just the peons bringing the words to life.
Somehow, I don't think it was Clark Johnson a peon. That's kind of hard to imagine. Clark Johnson peon?
Shaking a bunch of your boss.
Mark, the thing about the thing that's unique to The Wire, a couple things. One, the scripts are so detail-oriented, and all the stories are interconnected. And so sometimes we like to say it's like a sweater, that you pull one thread and the whole thing's going to unravel. So... I think I'd like to say the writers are sometimes open to dialogue changes when there are suggestions, but sometimes we just really have to be careful about changing the intent of any even the simplest, most trivial sounding line, because sometimes it can really affect something that's going to happen three episodes later.
We were doing, I think it was the second episode, the very first season, and I remember being out on some drug corner in East Baltimore, and... doing a scene where a drug slinger is talking on a payphone outside of a pinball arcade or something. And it was about 3 in the morning, and it was cold. And all of a sudden, a little tourist, a gray tourist, comes screeching up. And David Simon jumps out of the car, and he comes running over. I was directing that episode, and he comes running over me and says, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" I said, we're doing a scene where the guy's talking to his friend on the phone. He can't be in the pay phone because, well, Simon hadn't written the subsequent episodes, and he had had just a revelation that night. So, I mean, in the early going with the show, it became so dense, but the pilot was just out of Simon's head, and then these characters came to life, and these characters were slowly defined. So it really it gave a sense of what we're in store for, because for Simon to come screaming out of a Taurus at 3 o'clock in the morning to make sure that this guy wasn't actually in that phone book, because three episodes from now, the stuff that he had just written, that guy needed to be somewhere else. So,
welcome to the wire.
So, I mean, that's where the fluidity is, I guess, in the wire. I mean, because I've talked to some of the actors in the wire who say, well, when I first got the gig, I thought I was going to be told I'd be here for maybe one or two or three episodes and I'd be gone. But something happens in the process of writing and directing and producing and acting that characters develop and things happen that literally or change.
Well, I mean, it's kind of specific to each character. You know, my character arc, I believe, was already established, you know. They absolutely knew where I was going when I didn't know where I was going. So it was just basically establishing the parameter, you know. It's like, okay, you can go this far that way, that far that way, no further. You know, I didn't...
You can't tell you why.
Exactly.
You can't tell why.
But like Nina was saying, it's so detail-oriented. And, you know, most of us have been working in the industry for, you know, years and years and seen a lot of bad scripts. So, you know, when you come into something that was written, it's so tight, you know. For me, all I had to do was just trust and drop in, you know, and just let it flow. And it worked. I never had many circumstances where I was like, well, can I say this instead of that, you know? I never ran into that. It was really just very tight. I was like, you know, just get in the Lamborghini and drive, man. I mean, somebody gonna allow you to drive a Lamborghini, you know? You're gonna ask a lot of questions. You get in and you drive, you know? And I'm sure you're gonna have a good time, you know? That's how it was. That's really how it was for me. I never ran into situations where I had to fight to try to change something. It fit, you know?
So what is the kind of madness or sense of keeping it all so tight, keeping the script tight away even from actors or people who are working on the series? That it's, you know, that's like a top secret land. Wait, what, why?
I think the reason, the logic for it is that you know, as playing the character Cuddy, Chad would only know as much as Cuddy knows at any time, and so he had no way of knowing what his destiny was, what was down the road for him, and so just to keep the characters real as much as possible.
And because Simon was driving up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a little gray Taurus,
sure,
with some new shit for you.
And you were acting and directing in this series.
I only acted in this final season. I didn't.
You didn't direct any of the episodes?
I did the very last one.
The last one, that's right. Yeah, right. And you were in that one.
I'm in all of them this season, but...
So, a lot of people would ask the question, and I think that a lot of people who watch things and that directors do, and they're in the piece they're doing, how that works. It seems to be a strange process. It's like you're almost directing yourself while you're directing others and acting at the same time.
Yeah, it sucks. I remember when I first started directing on Homicide, and I was doing a scene with Johnny Sadie, and it was just two of us in a restaurant, and we were back and forth with the dialogue, and you get this actor flicker, your eyes start to bat around, and you know you're up on your lines, and I'm going up, I can't remember my line. How unusual. I used to keep him in my hat, my little, you're under arrest. That's why I wore the little pork pie. But anyway, so I couldn't remember my lines. And I'm starting to go up, and then Johnny Seda speaks. And while he's speaking, I'm thinking to myself, it's okay, I won't be on me for this bit. So, you know, that's the director, the little director, good director on this shoulder, little actor angel on this shoulder. Come on, Clark, come on, Clark. And it's right brain, left brain. I don't think you can define that easily, but it's really hard to do both. This season it wasn't so bad because I had the whole season to prep. every shot they dropped in episode one or two, I figured I was going to have to pick it up in episode 10. So I was ready for it. So it, and it became easier. So it wasn't as bad to do the both things this year.
So let's talk about that last episode for a minute. I mean, that was, to me, one of the most powerful closings of a TV series that I've ever witnessed. I mean, I'm not saying that's just a blow of smoke. I mean, it was just, I sat there and went, oh, my God, the very end. And just the what a lot of people have said in the conversations I've had about it is what was being said there? What was being said about the state of who we are and where we are, that's how we ended it, with a few messages of glimmer of people breaking through and others never breaking through. And just in the battle against the system itself inside the police department, how it all kind of ended. So I'm just curious what you all think, what that says, what the ending says to you as just people in this process.
Well, I really wish Simon was here. I mean, it was a really rough time when we were promoting the show that he was a stalwart in a WGA action, couldn't be involved in that, and it seems like he's ducking me personally. I think the whole Writers Guild strike was just because he thinks I smell bad, because we're never in the same room. Having said that, I try to speak for him when I can, because he's such a talented guy, and in terms of the ending of the series, I would characterize it as Baltimore is just going to keep going on. The good, the bad, and the ugly of Baltimore will continue. We just stopped talking about it. You know, you can have an ending like on The Sopranos where they're buying French fries or whatever and it goes dark. But we were just talking about Baltimore up until we stopped talking. Speak to that, Bill?
No, absolutely. I mean, it just continues.
Hold it closer to you.
It just continues. That's all. And I, you know, as far as I'm not sure if is the point of the questions, or are you sort of thinking of the montage, the ending montage, or which really
yeah,
was
I
about
mean, that's the
one, city itself?
I think it was the ending montage for me. It was the wrapping up what happened to characters and where they ended up. You know, and it was just. It, to me, and I'm just curious how you all felt about it. It seemed to me it was really kind of a philosophical wrapping up of a view of where not just Baltimore is, but where 21st century America is at the end of dealing with 20th century capitalism and what it's done to America, and what those closing pieces said about the condition we're in. I mean, it was a pretty heavy ending. This was not like la-di-da, like, let's have a French fry, or are they going to kill Mr. Soprano or not. It was something much more different than that, at least to me. Maybe I'm reading too much, but I don't think I am.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there were several things going on there. I mean, one is, you know, the at the same time, it was the tip of the hat to the city of Baltimore. You know, that was representative of what is going on in post-industrial America and in cities everywhere. And you know, the game's the game. You know, it just continues. And I think, you know, Clark is absolutely right. And
Anina, Chad? I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you. It goes on, you know. I mean, to not fall into any of, you know, entertainment tricks or games, you know, to stay true to it, you know. Oh, okay.
I'll take mine.
No, it's just, I just felt like, just like you said, the game continues, the truth continues, no one's trying to snow anybody over, no one's trying to go Hollywood, you know? It's really paying homage and
honoring
the city.
I was trying to go Hollywood. I don't know where.
Well, I mean, at the same time.
Right out there, please join us.
Is
it on? Smack it around a little bit. There you go.
As a former student of journalism, I particularly like this season. I want to ask Bill if you could tell us a little bit more about your writing process and trying to bring to the forefront the demise of journalism as I learned it anyway.
Geez, the demise of journalism.
Take it away, Bill.
Boom, boom, go.
I I guess I didn't really think of it as the demise of journalism. I just thought of it as sort of a snapshot of journalism as we're in the 21st century. In fact, we were criticized for not, you know, highlighting some of the pressures that are on the industry right now, other than the economic factors. I mean, a lot of what Simon and I did, I think, and really it was Simon, or Mr. Simon, as we refer to him, there were a few little messages that he put in there, but I mean, I think it really was homage to the craft. I'm sure I'm not answering the question, but I think what we wanted to do was show a newsroom in a very real way and show journalism in a very real way. And there were other messages there, like, you know, the Templeton foray into fiction and the idea that there were all these people running around reporting on news that while the rest of the city, you know, while Rome burned, that little message is there. The writing process, all those things were discussed. I'm not sure if I'm answering.
We're just witnessing the demise of journalism right here.
It's working. It's crashing and burning.
But that was your character.
Of course.
Yeah.
Gus Haynes, the patron saint of journalism. I had a blast playing that because it comes from these guys. That character came from their heart, and it was so cool to play. I was segueing away from the question, but to play this guy who spoke to some of the issues that were dear to Bill and David's heart. And the biggest compliment I could have playing that guy was real reporters come up to me saying, you know, that's kind of how we like to see it. We wish we had an editor like you. And I think that it was an homage as much as the guys were slamming the institution of journalism as it is in this country now. I don't think it's that much different than it was in the Hearst days. They started an unjust war there in Cuba, and hey, nah, I won't go there. But the idea that Simon was slamming the press, I don't think that's true. I think he was slamming the institution, slamming the powers that be, all the mergers that were happening. A great newspaper like The Sun, taken over by interests in Chicago, foreign bureaus being called home. All these things that are happening in print journalism were you know, discussed to at length on the show from the newsroom point of view. It wasn't a slam on newspaper people. It was a slam on the powers that be, which is, you know, vintage classic Simon. He hit every institution. It was just funny that the newspaper chose to take issue with this particular one. They didn't mind when we slammed the mayor's office or police force or the schools, but ooh, don't touch the
that really is hallowed. Very true. I've never met a bigger bunch of thin-skinned human beings as I've met this year, my former colleagues in the media.
Nothing compared to what, I don't know how many of you heard what happened in Washington when Zell, the new owner of the Sun and the Tribune, came to the D.C. bureau and looked out at everybody who was caught on tape, and he didn't know he was being caught on tape, and he looked out at all these reporters who were covering Capitol Hill in Iraq and said, "You are overhead." So that's the truth. I mean, what you all wrote is reality of what's going on. You are overhead.
And thank you very much for coming, everybody. It's been a great evening.
Thanks a lot. Cancel the dinner, no drinks. It's over.
Thank you guys for being here. I got two questions for Clark. Was there any intimidation factor in doing directing the last episode of such a critically acclaimed TV show? I mean, did it worry you? Did you lose sleep over it?
I don't scare easy. You know, this is family. I mean, I've been working a lot of faces out here that I've been working with since 93 in Homicide. It's a nurturing cocoon, and that's just, I can only say that because I'm going to get all weepy. But no, I didn't feel any pressure that. I'll tell you when I did feel pressure. I'm from Philly, and Mayor Nutty, the new mayor, invited some of us to come there and screen it there. And, you know, Philly's a rough town. And We're in City Hall, and there's 300 people watching the finale, and I thought, what happens if they have the same reaction they had to The Sopranos? They're going to be throwing shit at me. So that didn't transpire, and I'm happy. You know, I was in good hands because I knew the script was solid as soon as I got it, and it was wrapped up in an intelligent way, and I didn't feel I'd be letting anybody down. I just had to shoot it. The problem for Nina and Bill and myself in that instance was Simon just wouldn't stop freaking writing. So we just kept shooting, and Simon kept writing. And that's why it was 90-some pages, but I never felt like it was going to be anticlimactic.
That's cool. One of the blogs that was helping kill the newspapers, they were really complimentary of your direction in the last show. And they were looking at your motivation and whatever bloggers do. Is there any truth to what they surmised, that you got a lot of your motivation from Ford Wilgus?
Did he pay you? Get stand up, Wilgus.
$5.
You, for those of you who don't know Ford, let's have a round of applause for Wilgus. He is and always will be the Sergeant Bilko of Baltimore. You know, that's going back, Wilgus.
Actually, I don't know. For those of you who were here for the earlier panel and saw the clip where Dominic West is speaking in that fake Baltimore accent, Ford Wilgus actually was his model, his dialect coach for that.
So, Ford's worked on every show that ever shot in Baltimore and always will. Long after he's dead, he will still be putting time cards in on all the shows.
Bob Wisdom said to me that about the array of actors that were on this set, that there's never been a time in American TV or maybe even cinema where this array of African-American actors and talent were in one place at one time. This was like something that was just unique in the kind of the annals of TV and film. What do you think about that?
I saw a production of Pearly when I was a kid. No, I'm kidding. That's no faint praise. I mean, it could be the cynic of me, because I've been working for Simon for a while, is that there aren't that many shows with this big a representation of African-American actors. So it may be just by number, but I would have to agree that this is a really great cast, and it has been. And it's, as Chad would attest, it's unfolded with new actors coming in as we went along. I left the show and was gone for a couple of years and was amazed at some of the new people that came and stepped up and the ones that died. I mean, that's the show never glorified the drug corners. It was always, to me, that you may have a fancy car for a minute, you may have a pocket full of cash for a minute, but there's only two ways to go. That's jail or dead. So it was never really glorified. But having said that, because of that, We constantly needed a flow of actors, and Pat Moran and the New York casting people and everybody have been bringing. Every actor in Baltimore has been in the show, so that's a testament. And some of you, you know, are probably here tonight. So,
yeah, no, that's why when people would criticize and say, you know, as you're saying, like you're glorifying the drug trade and things of that nature, I was like, well, you obviously haven't watched the show, you know. So some people, you know, have certain agendas, which I understand, because industry-wide, you don't get a lot of diverse representation. But we went from the mayor's office to the streets, you know, and I don't think any other show was that inclusive or expansive in their representation. So, yeah, kudos to the show all the way, to the producers.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the writing for some of the black characters, particularly Snoop. One of my favorite scenes was when she goes into the Home Depot to buy the nail gun. And I'm wondering, you know, who wrote that? Did anybody, did she have any input into the dialogue in that particular sequence? And it was, I don't know, it just captured my attention. Now, when Bill was in the newsroom and was being given the double assignment about covering city courts and federal court, that sounded like pure Bill. But Snoop, I wonder how you write for that.
Yeah, you want
to? I'm trying to remember if it was David or if it was Ed who wrote that.
That was Ed who wrote that, wasn't it? Didn't Ed write that scene? Ed Burns? No?
I don't know. It was one or the other or both. I don't really remember. Or if Ed wrote it, it was Simonized. But in any event, Snoop
is a force of nature. I mean, Snoop just arrived on set one day, and we were sitting there, watching video, and Michael K. Williams came up and said, you know, somebody you got to meet, you know, and it was Snoop, and he just run into her as a chance meeting, convinced us and convinced Ed and David that, you know, she had to be part of the show, she's who she is. What you see up there is Snoop. I don't know how we could have written that.
But at the same time, I think I seem to remember her having Claire, the script supervisor, keeping her on book.
And this was the beginning of season. This was the beginning of season three, and Claire Copperthwaite was our script supervisor, and she was new to the show. She joined us then. Claire had never met anyone like Snoop before. When you talk about worlds colliding, this was Snoop and Claire. And Claire, who's a very well-trained script supervisor, felt it was her job to make sure that Snoop said all the words exactly correctly, the way they were in the script.
And in defense of my tribe, Simon had an incredible ear for dialogue. For a balding Jewish guy from the suburbs, unbelievable how he would just tap into. And a lot of times he could possibly listen to Snoop talking in conversation earlier on, and that would fold into the dialogue, which I'll explain the irony of that in a minute. Because, one of my favorite marriages imploded during the course of Homicide, and I found that that was being written about to a degree. So the writers, good writers anyway, will take from the characters that we're defining with them and roll some of those personal anecdotal stuff back into it. So when Snoop comes on set and is off book, it's probably something she said to Simon 2-3 weeks ago that he's written into the script and now insisting that she says it exactly as he wrote it, that she said it 2 weeks ago. There. Attica. Attica. Come on, actors, stand up. Attica. I had to. SAG.
Yes, sir.
Question for Mr. Coleman, and I guess Cuddy was probably one of my favorite characters, flashing back to episodes 3 and 4 here.
Right.
I just was wondering if you could tell us sort of the long, boring story about how you got the part in The Wire and if you were considered for any other parts.
Well, you know, I auditioned. I vaguely remember auditioning for Omar. Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Right. Why are you laughing?
You don't think you could do it?
Of course I could. I'm an actor.
And how many actors would take
Michael K., I hats off to Michael K. I mean, a tremendous, tremendous job. Just amazing. And, you know, the level of respect that he gets out there on the streets, you know, it's a testament to the work he's doing. Truthfully, yeah. I had an audition that they hadn't written the character. So I was reading sides from it, maybe from episode 2 and, you know, Cuddy premiered in the third season. So I had an audition, went in for the audition, got a call maybe a week later. They like you, they want to meet you. Went back in, and it was just a nice kind of collaborative effort. I, from what I understand, they've been trying to find this guy for a while, you know. And I'll just give you an example. Someone else, a very dear friend of mine, who went in for Cuddy as well. And at one point, after he read Nina and Ed and David, you know, they're trying to get him to zone in on who Cuddy's all about. And he says, is it like Obi-Wan Kenobi? So... So people were in left field with this thing. But, you know, I mean, I just remember Nina saying, you know, he's not sure of himself. He's, you know, he's just not sure of himself. So it's just an incredible mix of that, you know, insecurity and strength and you know, just actors who can do two things at one time, you know, it turns out, usually turns out pretty good, you know. So, but it was a great, I auditioned and we talked and I started to just get a real sense of who he was. Just talking to David and Nina. So when I did it again, I just clicked into this. It was one of those out-of-body experiences for me, really.
Like Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Strangely enough, but I'm glad I didn't say that because I'm sure I would have been out of the room. So, you know, you identify with that internal struggle with this guy, you know? He's in the same world, but it's a strange world at the same time, you know? So just clicking into that and, I think some good stuff happened in the room that day. So,
yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, it was one of those.
We weren't quite sure who this character was either. It was a new character for this season, and it's true, as Chad says, there's a lot of inner turmoil with this guy, that he has to be hard. He has a gangster history, but yet now he's at a point in his life where he's questioning a lot of how he's been operating and what he's been doing. And so we saw a lot of actors that day. And, I'm not just saying this because Chad's sitting here, but, you know, Chad auditioned and we made a couple adjustments and gave him some notes. And then we saw Cuddy. And, I mean, for Ed and David and I to agree on something is pretty rare, you know, without a lot of discussion. So, I mean, and that was one of the surest casting decisions we ever made, really. So.
David said, nice adjustment, you know. Then I was like, is that the kiss of death? Because people, you know, a lot of directors say that. You go, oh, boy. But I really felt like I walked out of the room and said, you know what? There was nothing else I could do in that room. That's how I felt. So I was happy that it worked out. And I was just honored to represent this guy. There's so many guys out there, you know, that's really their story. And there's so many people, you know, that would normally not say anything to me, you know. So these guys, you know, walk around carrying a lot. So for them to identify with the character in a way that they really wanted to just spend like 20, 30 minutes talking about it. Because I think they were just excited finally to see an accurate depiction and, you know, of their lives. It's like giving voice to their lives when most of the time people are trying to minimize them or, you know, push them to the side. So it was just great to be able to speak to those guys, man. It was amazing. The response was amazing.
One little sidebar here. I'll go right over here to the next questioner. But when you were saying that Nina was there with Ed and David, I think people don't realize unless you listen to our podcast, but that they didn't realize, Nina, that you were what an integral part of the production you are. Because people think of executive producers as kind of somebody who sits up here and handles the money and does all this, but you were in the middle of it all the time.
And the glue.
Yeah. I mean, the glue, as David even put it. So, I mean, explain a little bit about your role. Because people don't get it. It's the executive producer. People think that's kind of off here someplace, but not with you.
I'm getting pretty good at juggling, I would say. That's just it. I try to come to work every day and try to learn something new. Try to fill in the gaps and really just I'm a chameleon. I just try to do whatever it takes, and that's a different thing every day.
She's being modest. She who must be obeyed. Nina, I've known Nina since the beginning of Homicide when she was an AD, and she was a big part of that. And then from the get go on The Wire, when we were first getting the production office going, and Nina was like, When we lost Bob, it was always Nina that was picking up slack. So she's not tooting her horn, but I'll toot it for her because she had a lot to do with defining this show.
Amen. Right here.
I hope this is a story that you hear a lot, but after your season that was focused on the schools, I went out and I joined the board of Baltimore Freedom Academy. It's a Baltimore City high school that really is working. We graduated our first class last year, 95% of the kids going to college.
All right.
So it really crystallized for me that was something that I really wanted to give my time to. So I want to thank you for that, because we're about to expand to being 6 through 12, and we're out there fighting the good fight every day. But my question is, someone nicely gave me for Christmas, knowing I love The Wire, a book about The Wire. And the foreword in it is so eloquent about what you hope to achieve with the show, and I won't even come close to getting it right, but that basically it wasn't sort of a cops and robbers show or a bad versus good, and that it was really, the goal was to really examine where we are with the American city. And I just wanted to know, you know, when you walk around and you talk to people and you reflect on now this show that has ended, do you feel like you achieved what you wanted to achieve, and have you raised the dialogue about, you know, the city we're living in all across our country?
Bill, why don't you start?
I'm not even sure where to begin with. I'm sort of stuck in the Freedom Academy since I've done work down there myself. So,
yeah, it's a great place.
Getting a,
not a great building, but a great place.
Right. I'm not sure that, I mean, I think, I don't want to speak for the producers, but I think that we're all pretty satisfied with what was said. I sometimes wonder if it just has fallen on it's just out there in the ether somewhere. You know what I mean? That it's we tried to say the truth, speak the truth, write the truth, did that, and there it is, and you know, we're marching off to, you know, whatever we're doing now.
I think
these United States.
Shit would happen in the course of, and I can only speak for this season, really, in the first season, in my involvement, but this season, stuff would happen in Baltimore City as we were filming, and we knew that we wouldn't come on the air until months later. And we were going, damn, I wish we could let people know that we're already writing about this stuff. So I agree with Bill that I think a lot was said and enough was said about these institutions, and a lot of times that's my only regret, is that we couldn't, you know, go straight to air because we were talking about stuff that was happening in City Hall as it happened, and it wasn't because we were just listening to what they were doing. It was we were a little ahead of them in predicting what was going to happen, and that happened on more than one occasion.
Yeah, I think in answer to your question, I think we are satisfied that we've been able to raise the dialogue. I think there are people that are not that interested in these problems that we've illuminated, but through watching The Wire, maybe they've started to think about them a little bit, and maybe some of those people out there are the ones who are capable of solving these things or thinking about them in a different way. I know that David is frustrated that it hasn't happened more quickly, that the show has ended without much momentum on some of these issues that we've raised, but I'm optimistic that that still can happen because of you know, on demand and the DVDs now and everything. This show is going to be around for a while, and thanks to this exhibit here too. And so I hope that people will continue to think about the issues raised on The Wire and discuss them.
Chad, you want to jump in at all with this?
No, I think that was well said.
And people who put this out, I'll just tell you that when we did our podcast series with a lot of the actors and writers of The Wire, and all of them, we got to get to the rest of you, but when it hit the web, the response is overwhelming. There were people from all over the world who downloaded our podcast of interviews, and people wrote to be in touch because people are studying The Wire in universities all across the country and in Europe about to wrestle with 20th century America. I mean, I think it is having and it's going to end up having an effect beyond just the viewers that will have HBO when the series is live.
I mean, that's encouraging, but I'm still, you know, awfully cynical about what, you know, it might mean so far as change goes, really. I'm sorry to say.
No. You have to remain cynical about that, I think. But I think that cynicism and hope go together. But anyway, your turn.
When I was walking in, I like a dork, I pulled Bill aside, and I told him I teach at Walbrook High School up here on the west side of Baltimore. And as I can say, well, first of all, what's so interesting about The Wire is that, yes, there are people like Cuddy who go and round up kids and bring them to your classroom so they're on your roll once a month. That legitimately happens. And, I mean, I didn't know that this stuff happened. I think that what your show did is you showed people who never would have entered this world what that, I mean, it's real. And I wonder if there's anything more you guys wish you had gotten to say. I know the show got ended, it ended this year. What else do you think needed to be said about the zip codes that, you know, like, I forget the journalist's name in the last season, said don't get covered? You know, the, if you remember what I'm talking about.
I had something that I brought up to Simon right when I got here, and it was a direct result of a tragedy that happened at Virginia Tech. And I wanted, and it, there wasn't time in the course of the season, but what I wanted to get to was the responsibility that that media has in deifying these people and putting the guy with the bullet belts on the front page of the newspaper and letting him put his manifesto out so every nut who has an axe to grind, who wants to go out in a blaze of glory, knows that they'll get the cover of the Post. And I wanted to get that in. And Simon agreed it'd be interesting to talk about it. We talked about it a little bit with Bill that it wasn't, it was the responsibility of the journalist to put it out regardless of that fact. And that was something I wanted to get into, but 10 episodes and it wasn't all about the newsroom, so we never got to it. But that was one that I would have liked to have to address, because I think that's a real big problem. And it's happening right now with Obama and Pastor Wright, where the sound bites are killing us.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Clark, this is directed to you. You've done a lot of work with Homicide, with The Wire. You went off, you did some stuff with The Shield. What brings you back to Baltimore? How is the shows that you've done that are centered around Baltimore, you know, I mean, what keeps drawing you back?
I owe Ford Wilgus money. and he gets a cut of everything I make in the state of Maryland. Every time I leave this damn town, I look in my rearview mirror and say, well, that's it for Baltimore, but I always end up coming back here. In fact, my next movie is set in D.C., and hopefully we'll end up shooting it here. Something about the city. I as a kid, my grandfather worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad, and he'd bring the freights down to Camden Yard. I've always been coming here. I hate the O's. You know, I'll admit it. I haven't forgiven the Colts, and I bear that grudge for you. But other than that, I have no. I just like it here.
So who's your team? Toronto.
The Eagles.
The Eagles.
From Philly.
Oh, you're Philly boy. Sorry.
Represent.
Silly question. The Eagles. Answer.
Okay. This is for Miss Noble. At my job, we have to talk to a lot of clients, and a lot of our clients aren't in Baltimore. So on several occasions, they'll be like, oh, my gosh, I just saw The Wire. Are you okay? You know, and I think we get that, I say, once or twice a week. And I was wondering for you, Ms. Noble, as a producer, did the city of Baltimore worry about you affecting the tourist trade here? Because the show is very real. Did they ever say anything to you or any of the producers?
Yes. there were some discussions right around season two when it looked like we were going to continue going. There were some phone calls back and forth, and David's answer to that was, well, sure, I can go to Philly and do this show, but I'm still going to say it's Baltimore. So either way, but you know, I would like to respond to the idea that The Wire paints a negative picture of Baltimore. I don't really agree with that. I think The Wire is illuminating parts of the city that maybe people don't want to think about, maybe people that you'd rather not think about. But what David has done so well is to show the human side of those people, and to show each person, regardless of what type of character they are, with dignity and with humanity. So, there's probably a lot of things, you know, that you don't want to see, but that's part of the urban experience. It's not Baltimore per se. These are things, I think, that when people watch this show all across America, they're thinking about what's going on in their own city. They're not saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't go there on our vacation.
Yeah, I mean, there's 300 people who get killed in the streets of Baltimore a year. That's not part of the TV show. That's like what happens, you know. So it's kind of a realistic depiction of our fair city, or parts of our fair city.
And I think that would go all the way back to we had the same criticism on homicide, but we're telling the story. I just think this is a unique situation. What other show represents a city in that specific way, or in that all multifaceted way? Dallas? I mean, you know, CSI Miami? I mean, you know, Baltimore, and I've always said this, and I said it from the get-go on Homicide, is definitely one of the stars of the show. So, warts and all, this you know, it's represented. And there are people that are coming from Denmark and shit to go to the Inner Harbor and experience a little bit of the Wire culture.
and other characters. And it's not, you'll forget, I mean, that the Bubbles and the character Cuddy, those are prevalent and real all through the inner city of Baltimore, people who are making a change and fighting to make it a better place and standing up and coming out of that place to stand up and say no. Those are very real. That's real.
Absolutely. One in particular, Calvin Ford, you know. Calvin's right up there on Pennsylvania Avenue right now, you know, fighting a good fight at Upton Boxing Gym, trying to drag these kids off the street, out of the gangs and out of the drug trade, and, you know, trying to point them in the right direction. So, yeah, it's unheralded, but, you know.
There, little big man,
absolutely.
Cab driver.
Absolutely.
Important guy.
First off, just wanted to say thank you for that 1 hour a week that we're able to forget about the stress and the anxiety in our own lives and get involved in the stress and the anxiety that you've
so
all
you never
created.
Relaxed at all, right?
It was sure? A nice hour where we could forget about everything else in our own lives, so thank you for that. My question is, it's a lot of fun to watch, and I enjoy certain episodes, but I have favorites, and I'd be curious what each of your favorites were, for whatever reason, whether writing, producing, acting. When you look back on all of the series and all of the seasons, what is your favorite episode and why?
Start with Zorzi and work our way down.
Why don't we start on that end?
But you're Bill Zorzi.
Yeah.
Start at the end of the alphabet. That's
it. Start back with Z.
I mean, I'm not sure if I can speak to episodes. I mean, there's certainly certain scenes and characters that I love. I mean, I think back to season one. I think it was the third episode, the D'Angelo explaining the chess, the game of chess. You know, the kings stay the king. And I mean, I love that scene. I mean, and I'm not sure that I could broaden it out to say a favorite episode.
Not to be selfish, but it was a very, you know, pivotal scene in Cuddy's life when he went into Barksdale, you know, the guy that ran the whole drug trade and told him he couldn't do it anymore. I could only imagine what it was like for people like Calvin Ford, you know, who came to that point in their life. And also, it's just an opportunity for your average person to see him have that experience, which most people would like to think doesn't exist, but it does. So probably for me, that's the one that stuck out the most when he said to him, like, whatever it is that you have inside of you that let you do that thing, it ain't in me no more. And it was just, you know, that was a pivotal moment for me. I'll always remember that.
I'm not sure I can name a favorite episode either. The show was a 5-year arc, you know, and all the episodes were interconnected. So it's just the evolution of the whole thing. I would say that I have a lot of affection for season two. This theme of loss of work in America was really fascinating to me, and also the way that the show could divert so much from what happened season one and still keep keep viewers and add more after that.
I would agree with Nina, and to paraphrase Simon, it was a 160-hour movie or whatever, how many hours. But for me, the pilot, and the first three kind of blend together in my recollection, but me and Simon and Bob Colesbury were in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival trying to cast what would ultimately be Dominic West's role, and when the planes hit the towers. And so that had a lot to do with how, you know, what was in our psyches and in our consciousness and our emotions at that time. So the pilot, and then coming down here, and it was just Bob and Nina and Simon and myself gathering up all the crew here and putting together this cast. So it's more of that for me, more so than the ending, because I don't like endings. But I think that for me was the pip. That couch, you know, with kids in the low rises. You know, it just that was like that was the Jay Leno show right there.
Thanks, thank you.
Go Eagles! You and me. There you go.
Okay.
Second, thank you for doing this fantastic show. Thank you all. And finally, you've obviously all spent time in Baltimore, and what either a scene from The Wire or something just while you're in Baltimore, something to you that like encapsulates Baltimore. Like my favorite thing is when Herc is talking about what white guys dealing drugs. He's like, we need affirmative action for the stupid white drug dealers. Like what to you is like that explains Baltimore?
It'd have to be Lake Trout.
You know, it used to be like you say, well, it's crab cake, you know, or something like that. But I don't really have a one pinpoint thing. I think what I take away, really being in those neighborhoods, was really eye-opening for me. You know, places that you really didn't think people inhabited. And all of a sudden, the head would peek out the window and say, I am the Wire. So... So I mean, I knew the harbor and everything. I have family here, you know. So just really experience East and West Baltimore from the real hardcore perspective was, you know, for me, I'll always carry that with me.
Two things I would suggest from two different shows, because we're talking about Baltimore. From The Wire was Snot. And the reason why I mentioned Snot Boogie is he died because he always did what he did. That is such an interesting thing about this city, is that it's a city of familiarity. It's a city where it seems like all y'all know each other really well. And that's that. And that's what struck me. And then when I was here for the homicide, and we're sitting on Broadway getting ready for our medicals, and these two old, looked like old longshoreman guys, you know, maybe had 9 teeth and 7 fingers between them, were walking up the street towards me, and I overheard this snatch of conversation and said, I understand it's Barry's first venture into television. All right, so this is how we, you know. And again, I say that the show is rooted in these shows are rooted in the city, because it's shit like that that you just don't really experience elsewhere, except for CSI Miami, of course.
You're Baltimore boys, Rosie.
Yeah, it's hard for me to. It all seems like Baltimore to me, but I guess if I had to pick one thing that seemed most like Baltimore, or said Baltimore, it's the real Jay Landsman, who was I think his. Lieutenant Mello, I think, in the Western, when he says, anytime he opens his mouth, but specifically when he says, when he said something like, okay, you mutts, or words of that effect. And I think it's his Baltimore accent that sort of says Baltimore to me.
Thank you. So this series was such a I mean, everybody I've talked to who's been involved in it, it was such a an all-encompassing monumental experience being part of The Wire over all these seasons. Just what it took to think about the characters and write them and act them and direct them and putting these scenes together, making them so realistic and so vivid, you know, and not kind of a charade like Miami CSI, whatever the hell that is you said it was. But, so how do you do something after that? I mean, where do you go after that?
Well, I'm going to jump right in because I think that in a couple of years from now, there's going to be a town hall situation like this in New Orleans where they'll be talking and thanking Simon for bringing their city to life because the guy has a gift for it. And Nina can speak more to that, but, you know, I would imagine he'll do for New Orleans the same thing he did for Baltimore's, which is, you know, put that voice out there.
The Wire, we do it the hard way on The Wire, and we probably will in New Orleans too, because we don't know any other way. The Wire's toughest show I've ever done. I think we all would say that probably, but it's work you can be proud of at the end of the day. And so I think that anyone who's done any work on the show has come away a lot stronger and a lot. More appreciative of a sense of community that we all had together, because that doesn't happen on every production.
No, I said from the moment I became a part of it, it's like, wow, from filet mignon to McDonald's. So, and that's a lot of what's out there. So it's tough, but you know you have also have that aspect. You have to make a living. Feed your family and what have you. So it's really tough, you know. So I'm going to try to get in these guys' back pocket.
I don't know. Nina makes an interesting point. I have to say that I this is the only television production I've been involved with. I was a newspaper man my whole life. So, well, for most of my life, I did have one little venture into the bureaucracy. But so I guess this is all I've known.
Yeah, it's not usually like this.
Okay. Well,
it's not usually like this. This is rare.
I mean, there are other projects, you know, on the horizon. Not just New Orleans. There are a couple other things I think that are in the works. So, I guess you just keep pushing for things like that.
I want to thank all of you and everybody on The Wire for all you've done. I think it's been remarkable for all of us, and it's a you can look at the audience, the place is filled because of what's happened. So, and I also feel the presence of someone behind me. Must be that time.